Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do a review and stick it up here for you people to listen to on the podcast feed. And since the last time I spoke with the... I can't remember the last book that I reviewed, but I've been up to bits and pieces, really. The main news that I have is that I've started my own novel, a new novel that I'm actually writing myself, and I decided to write a fantasy novel, and it's going pretty well. I mean, it's a story that I've been thinking about. Actually, there's elements in this story which I first thought of probably around about 13 or 14 years ago, and wrote in a short story about 13 or 14 years ago, and so that element is coming in here. But otherwise, you know, it's been the last few years, like maybe the last 2 years, that I've really been considering this story that I've wanted to tell, and now I'm getting around to writing it, and it's flowing very easily. I guess when you think about a story that long, it comes out quite easily. Yeah. So that's going pretty well. Another thing is that I'm reading an audiobook at the same time as the book that I've just been just going to review this episode, by Heinlein. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. I'm exactly halfway through that and enjoying that quite a lot. But might as well just get straight on to today's review. It's a book by John Wyndham, or a short novel, I'd say, by John Wyndham called The Chrysalids. I say it's not a book, because I guess it was a book once, but I'm actually reading this as part of this John Wyndham omnibus that I bought in Bruges in Belgium a few years ago. And I think I reviewed The Triffids back on episode around about 30-something, 35 or something like that. So quite a long time since I actually read the first book in this omnibus. And the middle book is The Croak and Wakes. And I might read that again, but from all the books of John Wyndham, I think The Croak and Wakes is probably my least favourite. So maybe I'll read it again, maybe I won't. I'll see how it goes. But the final book in this three-book omnibus is The Chrysalids, so I thought I'd give it a read again. And the main reason, I've wanted to read it for a while, but because this is actually a real book, I'm actually tapping it here, and isn't just an audiobook or an ebook that I read on my iPod or my iPhone. The reason I'm reading this now is because I've got quite a lot of time at home, and I want to save up the ebooks for when I'm traveling, so I don't actually have to carry any books with me while I'm traveling, and I can read the actual real books while I have them at home without having to carry them around, because this is a big chunky book. And because it's three novels in one here. So The Chrysalids isn't itself a very long book. It's only, well, I can't work out how many pages. Probably around about, 250 pages or something. Not a lot, not a big book at all. Quite short, actually. And oh yeah, I just remembered another reason why I wanted to read this is because Jesse from the SFF Audio Podcast decided that he was going to read the book because he teaches students and one of his students was studying it at school. And The Chrysalids is probably a book that most people probably read for the first time when they're at school, because it is one of those kind of things, like when you're 13 or 14 year old, it is one of these books that you'll read that at. You know, a bit like 1984, and there's quite a few of these books. I remember some of the science fiction books that we read in our English classes. One was called Z for Zachariah, depends if you're American or British, or the name of that, and that is set after shortly after a nuclear war, and it's only a few people left alive in this small valley in somewhere in America, I'm guessing. And this book is slightly different in the same way, I guess, you know, because I grew up in the 80s, and the books that I was reading even in the 90s were still very much influenced, the choice of books was still very much influenced by the Cold War and stuff. And this book is, again, very influenced by the Cold War. It was written in 1955, and it is very much set after, it's like a post-apocalyptic. There has been, I mean, they never mention that there's been a nuclear war in the book, because they just call it the Tribulation. But about 1,000, maybe 2,000 years in the past, there has been this great nuclear war, and everyone is wiped out except for little parts of the world, little pockets of the world, which are a little bit further away from civilization, and those places survive. So all of this book is set in a part of Canada called Labrador, and they mention a few other places around the area. They mention a place called Newf, which is obviously Newfoundland, where I'm actually going next month. I'm visiting Newfoundland for the first time. And yeah, so that's pretty much the only places in that area of North America that survive. Newfoundland is and Labrador. I guess most of the action happens in Labrador. So that's the climate there has picked up a little bit. It's a bit nicer than normal. And there's like this agrarian society built up there. And because not a lot survived after the nuclear war, they don't really have any previous history. The Bible survived and a few other bits and pieces survived, but not a lot. They're not really quite sure what's going on. However, one thing that has happened with all of the nuclear fallout and the radiation, there's been masses and masses amounts of mutation, not just in plants and animals and things, but also in humans. So this totalitarian kind of religious regime seemed to have been created in the past to preserve the purity of the human race. So it's a rule to stop mutants. So the idea is that it's blasphemous to have any kind of mutation. So if you're not created in the image of God, because God created man in the image of God, or in the image of gods, as it says in some translations of the Bible, let's make God in our image. Like I was saying, oh, okay, well, it's a bit strange. Anyway, I won't get into that now. But the idea is that, yes, man should be like this. So one of the holy books is the Bible. Another holy book is a book full of descriptions of all different kinds of animals and specifically humans as well. And if you're born and the inspector comes in, and you're not a pure human, say if you've got an extra toe or, you know, a long arm or something like that, it means that you're no longer worthy in the sight of God, and you'll be, it's never really quite wrapped up always what happens to these small children, but generally they're sort of cast aside or put down in some way, you know, and it's really bad. But if they grow up a little bit longer and this, you know, their mutation is only noticed later on in life, or maybe if they managed to hide their mutation, or the parents managed to hide the mutation long enough, it means that then they can they're just cast out of the society, and they're sent to live in what's known as the fringes. So you've got like this pure, like a little pure human society living, you know, farming, and there's some towns and stuff like that going on there. But then out on the fringes, where the radiation is still holding sway a bit more, that's where you get the people of the fringe, and they're the more mutants, and they live in their colonies out there. But it's really hard life out there because, you know, plants don't grow very well, or if they do, they might not be edible and all that different kind of stuff. So that's pretty much the setup there. The level of technology, like I say, is pretty low. They've got one of them's got a steam engine, and guns are mentioned, but generally it's, you know, people living on farms, and that kind of stuff there. They do see some old ruins, you know, and there's like they talk about this right at the very beginning of the book. The protagonist of the book, David, he's a young boy at the very beginning of the book, and he finds there's this ridge near the farm, and it's obviously like a motorway that's been built, like a raised motorway section, but of course they don't know about it. For them, it's just the old people, these people who must be giants or must have been giants in the past, because all their buildings are so big and everything that they did was big. They must have been giants. So that's where all the action takes place. However, we do know a little bit more about the wider world, because David's uncle, called Axel, he was a traveler once, and he went on a ship, or he went on a few journeys on a ship and saw other parts of the world, and he thinks it's a bit strange because you know, the other parts of the world that Axel went to, you have other societies there, and they're all like, ah, no, we are the real people, you know, we are the made in the image of God, or we're the real humans, even though they've all got six toes or three arms and things like that. So it's a bit strange that the people who come from this, you know, Labrador, they're all saying, no, we're the pure ones. And then other places are going, no, we're the pure ones. So they've got that whole kind of thing going on. Now, the world itself is quite comfortable. And that's one of the things that John Wyndham has often been criticized for, that he writes these cozy apocalypse, you know, everything happens, but, you know, okay, it's all great. We're all sort of like middle class. Well, here it's not really middle class, you know, it's more like working class farmers and stuff, but everything actually is quite good, you know, and it's all right. It doesn't matter that the world's come to the end. We'll all be good. We'll all have this nice food and we'll get along with each other and it's all great. However, this book isn't quite like that. It starts off like that in a way. It's quite comfortable because it's told through the eyes of a boy. And then he grows up and it becomes less and less appealing because at first, like I say, quite comfortable. Then you start realizing actually how brutal the existence is there, which is being sheltered from him as a child. And of course, later on, he realizes more and more stuff about his childhood as he's growing up, and he looks back on it and goes, "Oh wow, I could have died then, or that could have been really bad." And then these other things happen too. And the good thing about the world is that because it's set after this apocalypse, it holds up remarkably well. Even after, like, this is from 1955, so it's 55 years later, and it's still, you know, it's still just as real. It just feels just as real as it ever was. Like the other book the other story, Day of the Triffids, that I reviewed from John Wyndham. Again, that's sort of based sometime in, you know, in the 20th century, sort of mid 20th century kind of time, or, you know, sort of. Maybe in the 1960s or something, you know, sometime around about then. And it doesn't, even though it's still a good book, there's still sort of the science and the society isn't quite the same, you know. There's no, you know, because it's based on its own time, whereas this is based in a future time, but past the apocalypse, it does hold up quite well. So on to the plot. And the plot is pretty much follows the story of a kid called David. His name is David Strom or something like that. And at the beginning of the story, he's just a kid, like I said, and the story opens with him meeting up with this little girl called Sophie, and they get along quite well, and she's also like 6 years old, but unfortunately she has six toes, and this is the first time that David really gets an inkling of actually what the situation is with this whole, you know, mutants being cast out and things like that. So she has to leave, her parents take her away, and they go and live in the fringes, and David is left without one of his friends, and that's how the book opens. And then David starts growing up, and by the end of the book he is fully grown, and then the big sort of action finale comes when he's around about 20 years old, so it's like pretty much telling his life as he's growing up. However, he discovers that he has a mutation of his own. He's always known it, but it sort of becomes clear to him that he is actually quite unique, and this is some form of mutation. We find out about this very early on in the book, and it turns out he has a form, he's capable of a form of telepathy, and so do like 8 or 9 other children in his general area. And the way it works is that they can just project sounds and pictures to each other, or sort of like a combination of sounds and pictures. He explains it to a few people throughout the book, you know, it sounds quite an interesting thing. But the thing is, as he grows up and the world gets harder and harder, and, you know, not just for him, but all of the other kids who are telepathic, they, you know, they have to try and hide it. And, you know, slight spoiler here, they are discovered later on in the book. But like I say, it's a fun novel and you should read it. And if you have read it, you know what's happened. And if you haven't read it yet, I don't want to spoil it. I won't talk much more about the plot, but it is quite a slow plot in a way, but it is a short, but no, it's not a slow plot. It's a steady plot. Let me put it that way. There's an event here and then a conversation here and then another event and then another year later, something else will happen. And then another year later, something else will happen. So it, like I say, it's spread over a long time, but it's actually quite fast moving, and it moves from one thing to the other. And because it's told sort of first person, looking back on his childhood, he ties the events together. He's like, well, this happened, then this happened, and then another the next year that reminded me of this, and it paid off a bit later on here as well, you know. So I thought it was actually quite a clever telling in that way, that it can just skip over things, and some things which you'd think would be really important, you realise that David, the narrator, is actually skipping over because it's private or something like that. He develops a relationship with another one of these kids who is telepathic, and it's great. And it just says at one point, "Oh yeah, and of course we always thought we would get married." You know, for him it was just natural, so he just sort of skips over it, which is actually, I think, quite a good thing, rather than writing out like a long, we're falling in love with each other, because they're telepathic, they just know about it, and it just goes through. So some things like skipped over in that way, whereas other things go into a lot more detail. But this book is very, very much about, and I'll get onto this later, of course, when I talk about the themes, very much about the sort of like the social, not just social outcast, but like the racial outcast, and I'll get onto that later. But what happens is that anything in the book, like literally every line in the book, is talking about this situation and what it is like to be this tiny minority in this sort of like religious fascist society there. So there is a bit of thing, like at the end of the novel, you could, well, this time I was reading it, and I've not read this book for quite a long time, although I have read it probably like 5 or 6 times before. And I was thinking, oh, wait a second, I remember this end. Is it a bit more of like a deus ex machina at the end? But it really isn't. You know, if someone is expecting to be rescued and they're doing their best to wait until they can be rescued and then they get rescued, I'm thinking, okay, that is allowable. Maybe I've spoiled it a bit at the end, but I really haven't. I've really tried stuff. But, you know, like I say, the end of the novel really needs that final event for the themes. You know, there's a bit of preaching and a bit of here. Actually, I'll talk about that later on. I think it'll probably fit later on in my review. So the characters are interesting, but not that complex. They fulfill the roles. You know, John Wyndham, not exactly known for his complex characters. David, our protagonist, is stupid, but he never really takes control of the situation, but I think he's suitably stupid in a way, because all the way through the book, other people are like showing him the way. You know, they're going, oh, okay, and you need to do this, and he's like, oh, right, and stuff like that. And then this, you know, horrific events happens at the end of the book, and he sort of just rolls with it, and he's that kind of guy. You know, there's like a character called Michael who we never actually really meet him like in purpose. Oh yeah, we do a few points. We meet him in person, but most of what he is, he's another telepath, and he's actually a much stronger character. And he's, at some point, he's like one of the characters driving the plot, but we don't really see things through his eyes in that way. And it'd actually be a bit strange, maybe not strange, it'd actually be quite interesting to read his story, like to retell the same story, but from his point of view. Would it be more interesting? Would it be less interesting? Probably slightly less interesting, but I think he has actually got a stronger character, even if he isn't a stronger character, if that makes sense. You know, he's more forceful and things like that. But like I say, David does grow up throughout the novel, and yeah, like I say, suitable, but sometimes I just wish he'd have stronger opinions. But then again, for the end of the book, maybe he's not allowed to have stronger opinions. A bit strange there. So, science and technology stuff, not a whole lot in this book. I mean, I could, you know, not in terms of gadgets and widgets and cool science fiction-y kind of stuff there. But then again, that's not what John Wyndham is really about. He does like take a situation, and he doesn't actually, like I say, this is his most realized world, I think, because normally, like I say, it's 20th century and then something happens, something invades, something turns up, a discovery is made, and then he sort of plays it out from here, whereas this is sort of like a whole world that he's created, and very well. Now, I'm not quite sure how scientific it is, like, in today's world. Of course, like, the telepathy, these days, telepathy is a pure fantasy kind of thing, but maybe back in 1955, telepathy was much more of a mainstay of science fiction. I reviewed SLAN, and that's, I think, all about, you know, telepathy and this and that there, whereas this is much more... you know, the telepathy is there, but it doesn't have to be explained scientifically, except for, like, you know, hand waving, oh, it's a mutation, and it's like, oh really, it's a mutation. But there's this whole kind of thing with mutations, like, well, why are these 7 kids all mutated in the same way at the same time? But then you're thinking, wait a second, this is a mutation which nobody knows about, and nobody can see, and things like that. So there's a whole more possibilities. So it almost, what had to be here, it almost had to be telepathy or something hidden within the brain, because if it wasn't, it would be very difficult to tell a story about a mutants who aren't recognized as mutants in this way, which is an interesting way of doing it. So but yeah, maybe it's fantasy, maybe it is science fiction. I'm not really that bothered about that distinction. I just think it's an interesting book. You know, my definition, actually, I think John Wyndham wrote about this, was it like logical fantasy or something, he said, so it doesn't really matter that it's not scientifically plausible, but as long as the fantasy is logical, it works as a, you know, a speculation kind of fiction, which is pretty good. So writing style. Yes, I made a note here. Someone emailed me about this review that I'm doing now, or, you know, they emailed me before I started, of course, and they said John Wyndham often feels like he wants to be more jocular and light and more jokey, which is what jocular means, I guess, than he is, and he always has to sort of rein himself in, or that's what he does in some of these books. And I actually quite feel that quite a bit myself, that you think that if he wanted to, it's like he could be telling jokes all the time, and he does rein himself in, certainly at different parts of this book. You know, it is funny, very funny in places, but a lot of the time you're thinking, okay, he's obviously a very, very good writer. You know, he does dialogue very well. He does preaching maybe slightly less well. But generally it could, you know, it flows with good pacing and everything, but you can see that he could do better. He could do more. And I think this is probably why this is often taught as a kid's book, because it is such a light read. Well, it isn't just a light read, but it can be a light read because, you know, just because of the tone of the novel. So, yeah, maybe that's why it's a kid's book. But then I guess, you know, 1984, I think I read that at school, and that has a completely different tone again. But I guess we'll see how it goes. I should really review that book. One complaint. Made a note here, is that the telepathic conversations are pretty dull, which is a bit strange because he's a telepath. You know, he's doing, you know, I know for him it's just natural that he's doing it, you know, and maybe as a kid, you know, he doesn't think it's anything unique or strange, but then he describes the telepathy in a really interesting way. And there's this glimpse of what it's like when he's teaching a new telepath how to use their telepathic talent. And it's quite interesting. But then when he's written down the conversations, the telepathic conversations, they're rendered in plain English. And I really think John Wyndham missed a trick because he could have made it a lot more magical. But then again, maybe he doesn't want to make it magical. Maybe he wants to make it a bit more mundane. I'm not really sure what's going on there, but it would have been nice to have a little bit more to go on there, a little bit more, delight, a little bit more. I don't even know what the word I'm trying to say there, but anyway, it's a bit strange. But yeah, very well written, very easy to read as well, a very quick read too. So bringing on to the main part of this review, I guess, is the themes of the book, which is what I always sort of really start ranting about. One thing that I really like is the idea of religion outstaying its welcome, because you very much get this here, you know, in the book with the idea of that. Or let me put it this way. You can look at religion from like an evolutionary kind of Darwinian standpoint, that religion was complementary to humanity's continuing existence and adaptability. Let me put it that way. That back in the day, when you were in small tribes and the world wasn't explained, it was way before science and everything like that, maybe religion had a good role, a very helpful role with very early humans and, more, well, not even very early humans until a few thousand years ago. It was very, very handy because, you know, the technology wasn't there and you needed to explain stuff. And also, you know, it gave a moral code and it kept people in line and it kept people together so they could, you know, and an enemy came in and they could sort of like, okay, we're going to fight for God, and all these different kinds of reasons why religion was good for man. But now man has got past that, and now religion in a way has its own evolutionary advantages, but only for itself. For example, the way that with religious dogma, you know, they say, okay, this has to be this way. And the whole thing, like, you know, if you leave Islam, it's okay not to be Islamic, but then if you are Islamic and then you leave it, you have to be killed. Now, that is a really good incentive, not for humans to be Islamic, but for Islam to continue existing. Well, it's not a good argument for it or anything like that. It's just if a religion is set up that way in, say, like Pakistan or Afghanistan, and this is actually what happens, people get out of their death penalty for leaving Islam by declaring themselves insane. You know, they put an insane plea in and they don't have a death penalty. They just get locked up for leaving Islam, which is just this bizarre thing. And the only thing this really helps is the religion itself. And there's so many different examples of this. This is why cults are so insidious, really, is because they are completely self-serving. The only thing that they actually serve is themselves. It's a bit like the Catholic Church as well. The only reason the Catholic Church exists now is because it set itself up as an institution with rules to keep itself existing. You know, that's the whole reason, or that's the reason why lots of people say that priests have to be celibate. It's because what used to happen is that the sons of the priests would inherit their father's money and then not be priests themselves, and the money would leave the church. Whereas if all the priests are celibate, you know, everything that the church owns stays within the church. And I'm not saying this is good or bad or wrong or right. It's just that is actually what happens with religion, is that the religions that survive are the ones that have the rules in place that are good. I mean, that's why, again, just Christianity in itself, the reason why Christianity is so appealing to so many people is that you get forgiven for your sins and you get rewarded in heaven. I mean, that's a really good thing. Now, imagine a religion where you don't get forgiven for your sins and you've actually got to pay for them, which is a bit like more like traditional Catholic stuff. You know, you've got to confess your sins and you've got to, you know, say the Hail Marys and stuff like that. But you don't need to do that in the Pentecostal churches. You just go to the front of the church, say your sorry, and that's it. Now, I don't want to be preaching myself here, but this is one of the main themes, or it is a theme which is expressed quite well in the book, that humanity moves on and gets to a point where it doesn't actually need the religion anymore. And of course, I do actually think that in this book, the religion played a massive part in the creation of Wacknock and the other villages around there, and the and the pure human society that is in Labrador and Newfoundland. There, the religion was really, really helpful for the people who are, you know, against, you know, trying to stand up against mutants and trying to keep the race pure and stuff like that. Now, there is a discussion, is like, were they actually the pure humans? I mean, I'd love to, you know, it's one of those things that I always used to think when I was younger. It's like you get to the end of the book and you actually realize that everyone has three ears or four eyes or something like that. And everyone has just presumed that that was the mutation. And we only found out about that like in the last few lines of the book, is that they, you know, they arrive somewhere else and they're like, oh, wow, you don't all have three eyes around here. You know, you're not in the image of God. And we've always thought that the people in the book were that same kind of stuff. You know, that's the kind of thing that you expect from maybe a short story, but this is a novel, so it probably wants to take itself slightly more seriously than that. But yeah, religion was really, really helpful. But it's getting to the point, it's that turning, the book is, the story, the characters are at this turning point, and the society is at this turning point, where they're getting to, you know, they're at that place where they don't really, really need religion anymore. And they can, they can be saying, okay, well, it's not, is it really, really that bad that someone has this minor little thing wrong with them? Like they have six toes instead of five, you know, and we could be forgiven. It's like, are they really not actually in the image of God? And they really not human just because of the extra little, you know, toe that they have there? And I just think it's actually a very good exploration of this question. It's like, what is the point where religious extremism is no longer helpful for society? Well, not even religious extremism, but, you know, just the, like, the an overbearing kind of hold of religion on a society. When is it no longer beneficial for the people in it, and when does it become, you know, detrimental? And this is like telling a story of, you know, it is that time when the religion is starting to become detrimental. So that's an interesting theme. There's a few others, but I might as well just get straight on to the main one here, which is, again, I think superficially you could say this is a book about racism and tolerance, but I think it's actually much broader than that. And other people say, you know, it's more of a discussion of, you know, one group dominating another. This is a theme that actually is touched on in many of John Wyndham's books, you know, especially just the ones here in this omnibus. You've got the Day of the Triffids and the Kraken Wakes, tales of like a new species that comes onto the earth and turns in, you know, through different situations, turns into the dominant species of earth and being a threat to a different species. Another book that he wrote called The Midwich Cuckoos, which is actually a story of, you know, telepathic children. It's like the opposite of this story, because that's told from the point of view of the old sort of race humans, like normal baseline humans, and then these new children come up along with like some kind of telepathic hive mind kind of thing, whereas this book is very much from the point of view of the telepathic children living in the intolerant world around them. But time and time again, John Wyndham talks about this, you know, this idea of species coexisting with each other, and, you know, the conclusion that he always comes to, or always seems to come to, is that really, that's probably not going to happen. There's not really a chance of new species existing with the old dominant species. One will prevail, you know, and it's a bit, put it this way, it's quite hard to argue with him when we go, hey, wait a second, where are the Neanderthals? And you're like, oh yeah, where are the Neanderthals? And you're thinking, actually, this is what humans do. And I've mentioned this before, that, you know, one of the reasons why there aren't other intelligent species on land is probably because humans have, you know, anytime a species becomes intelligent enough to threaten humans in any way at all, you know, if apes started getting a little bit more intelligent and they, you know, start picking up weapons, us humans, well, maybe not now, but in the past, we'd have just wiped them out. And that's probably why the next most intelligent animal after humans doesn't live on land. They're dolphins, and it's really, and it was always a lot more difficult to kill dolphins. So dolphins probably, you know, I'm not an expert on dolphin intelligence, but they're much more intelligent than anything on land except humans. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that does happen. And John Wyndham really does sort of like explore that quite a lot in quite a lot of his stories as well. And but again, I think this book is taking it to another level. I read the end of the book and I was like, wow, this is more preachy than I remembered. Because like the message at the end of the book, and I don't really, maybe I'm going to give away, but I don't want to spoil the bit. What I'm trying to say is that by talking about the themes in depth here, I might spoil the end of the book, not plot-wise or character-wise, and not actually what happens, but I don't want to tip the hand of the author. So maybe skip forward 10 minutes if you don't want to see me sort of like say what I think John Wyndham is trying to say here. But I know that other people missed this. So maybe, you know, maybe if you might have missed this as well. But anyway, at the end of the book, one breed of humans, let me put it this way, it is the telepaths, they are seen to be superior to the other ones. And some quite horrific acts take place at the end of the book. And like I said, David, being a bit stupid, he sort of goes with it. And I was thinking like, oh, you know, and he gets convinced by, you know, some preaching of another telepath, you know, and it's like, okay, this is good, this is good. And then he just goes with it. And I was thinking, okay, this is not a tale about racial prejudice, because it could be. You know, they have this whole sort of chase across. They get found out and they chase across. And I'm thinking, okay, this was written in 1955. Probably commenting, well, definitely commenting about, like, the, you know, the Second World War and, of course, the Holocaust in particular there as well, you know. And there's these Jews who look like everything else, but they're different, but they can't really be seen to be different, you know, except maybe guys don't have the foreskin, but it's really difficult to see them. And, you know, it's a whole artificial kind of, this is pure humanity, this isn't. And we all have to be, you know, and like in the Holocaust, you know, these like mutants are hunted down and driven out and sent into camps and things like that. However, something happens at the end of this book which really shows what I think John Wyndham is saying, and that is because you know, racial and genetic purity, you know, the world with mutants, good idea, okay, brutal fascism, is it a good idea? Maybe, you know, it's like some days, like I was saying before with this other theme, you know, but, you know, and humanity purges the weak and the impure, and it goes like that. However, when this new superior group arises, this group of telepaths arises, they turn out to be just as vicious as the old group. In fact, more vicious than the old group, because it was getting to the point where the old group, you know, just like the basic, you know, the people who would expel the mutants. In the end, they were getting to the point where they were almost doing it out of kindness, in a way. You know, it's like the same kind of kind, not that they thought they were humans, but it's like the same kindness that you'd show animals. They wouldn't just kill them outright. But they could be like expelled to the fringe, you know, and they're out there, they're a nuisance, but hey, you know, they were, you know, people really, so there were people too, you know. But the new group that comes along, you know, these telepaths, they treated the humans with utter contempt. And they're saying, you know, there's lots of these speeches like, oh, life is change and humanity has to move on. But then again, life is change, but only if change is to their liking. And it's like, would they want to be treated in the same way that they're now treating the old humans? And of course, the answer is, I bet you not. So it's more than about like racism is just bad, you know, okay? Because I mean, that's almost too easy to write that kind of book, you know, oh, these people, they're persecuted. Oh, isn't it bad? You know, like that, you know, not... you know, I don't want to talk down, you know, I don't want to diminish the you know, books that do talk about this and things, but I think this book is taking it the same way. There's three different factions, you know, there's the pure humans, the telepaths, and the mutants. And I really like the view of Uncle Axel. Did I mention him before in the review? I think it did. Anyway, Uncle Axel, David's Axel, and he thinks, like, because he's seen all these different groups, and they all think that they're the real humans. They all think that, you know, they're the real image of God in that way. And he's like, well, I think everyone should just get on with life, you know, the mutants want that, we want that, you know, like that. However, it's quite easy to say, oh, I just think everyone should get on with each other. If you're like at the apex of evolution at that time, if you're just a pure human, but if you're not at the apex of evolution, if you want to put it that way, if you're not the new upcoming master race, well, if you are the upcoming master race, that's not really a handy view, because actually you don't just want everyone to get along, because some of them aren't getting along with you. It's a complex situation, but I think that Uncle Axel guesses that David and the telepaths are sort of in ascendancy. They're the ones who are going to be running things in the future. And he's sort of instilling in David like this tolerant point of view, sort of maybe subconsciously, if he's doing that or not, you know, I'm not quite sure. But it's like he's wanting the future, when David's kind in charge, to be kind to him in the same way that he wants everyone to be kind to the mutants, even though they're not. So he's trying to sort of like pass on like a better sense of morality to the new group than his group has in itself. So yeah, I think this book is, again, like it's about more than persecution. And again, it comes back to the ending. Like, people complain about the end of this book. I've heard people complain about the end of this book. But the way that the telepaths act at the end needs to happen. It needs to show that any group can switch from being persecuted to persecutor. And that's a hard... like, it's a hard pill to swallow, you know. It almost spoils the end of the book, because David, the main character, just goes along with it, and he hardly thinks about it, you know. He's like going, oh, okay, well, I'm on the powerful side now, you know. Oh, well, that's good, that's handy. And it's like, I'll just forget everything that my Uncle Alex told me. But maybe that's the reason why the protagonist actually had to be stupid all the way through, and he didn't have to quite grasp what's going on. Maybe he's got this girlfriend, Rosalind, and I think she sort of grasps what's going on. And she's sort of someone with brains. And maybe, like, the preaching at the end of the book, which I don't think is in John Wyndham's voice at all, you know, because I think he's speaking through Uncle Alex rather than speaking through this, you know, this telepath at the end of the book. And I'm thinking, okay, he's the guy, you know, Uncle Alex is the point of view that John Wyndham is saying. It really is that we are all, even if we're not all human, we all have to, you know, get along, we've got to live and let live and all this kind of stuff. And you can't switch from persecuted to persecutor in Revenge. I mean, because that is what they do in a way like that. And you can't just dismiss other people who aren't in a group. So the ending of the book is highly cynical. You know, it's presented in this kind of, and ironic as well, because it's presented in this like, and they all lived happily ever after. And I'm like, well, they don't really all live happily ever after, do they? Because you realize that this new telepathic group don't actually care anything at all for individuals, even though these people are individuals all the way through. They don't care about David, they don't care about Michael, they certainly don't care about this other telepath called Rachel or Rosalind. If you read the book, you'll understand what they do care about, and it isn't actually for individuals or humanity in any way at all. And maybe that's why the like this hive mind, you know, telepathy kind of idea is so scary to people in a way, because, you know, the individuals are just like, yeah, well, they're just one person, you know. It's like, oh yeah, and all these people, they're not part of the hive mind, well, you know, we don't, or they're not part of the telepathic group, so, you know, so it's a bit strange, like I say. So what I'm thinking is that maybe, like I say, the stupid protagonist is a strength of the book rather than a weakness of the book. Maybe I'm just making excuses, but I really don't think I am, because I do think, you know, John Wyndham is being very, very clever with his book here. It's not cut and dry. Well, to me, it's cut and dry in a way, but it's cleverly cut and dry in a very sort of, like I say, this ironic, cynical kind of view. And actually, like I say, because the entire novel is like a setup to this payoff, which takes place in like the last three or four pages of the book, I think what'd be actually interesting is to have a sequel to this book, which actually talks about David and Rosalind in the future, and maybe Rosalind loses her telepathic powers or something like that, and then David actually has to see her as an old human again. He's maybe like, oh well, she's not one of us, maybe she isn't worth anything anymore, and then he can then relive what he's just been through, but then from the other side, the thing is, I'm being way too blatant about this, and I think the reason why John Wyndham did it is because he did it so much better and so much more subtly. You know, it's much clever a way of doing this. So anyway, that's what I have to say about the themes of this book. Very, very cleverly done. And I think, to be honest, I probably did just spoil the end of the book, but again, not by mentioning the events, but just by talking about the themes and the ideas of the book. And maybe I've distilled it down into something too small, and maybe reading the book itself is a better example. But again, like I say, read the book and you can make up your own mind about the intentions of the author, because, you know, he's dead. So it's up to you to decide what he thought about now. So to rate this book, very, very, very enjoyable. I enjoy this book a lot more than a lot of the books that I've read in the last few years. Again, not totally perfect, but really good. I think I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. And again, I know this is a lot about nostalgia, about reading this book many times, but I still think it says a lot today and means a lot today. And there's literally, except for maybe like the sort of like sniffing kind of view towards telepathy in science fiction now, I don't think there's anything in this book which doesn't hold up even to this day. So 4.5 stars. I think I enjoyed it more than Triffids. Let me actually look up how many stars did I give the Day of the Triffids? Let me look on here as well. Oh, I gave Day of the Triffids 4.5 stars. So maybe, again, could be a nostalgia thing. Maybe John Wyndham is one of my favourite science fiction authors again, because really he doesn't put many feet wrong. Or maybe, and this is, you know, it's a selecting kind of thing, that I'm only rereading the books of his that I actually really like. So maybe I'll read The Kraken Wakes and see if I enjoy that book as much as the other two books that I've now reviewed here. So 4.5 stars for John Wyndham's The Chrysalids. Check it out. Read it. It's very well worth it. Even if you read it in high school and now you're thinking, oh, I didn't really like it when I was 13. I think you'll probably get a lot more out of it now. So the next book that I'm going to review is probably going to be The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert A. Heinlein, and that'll be coming, well, I'm going away to the Berlin Juggling Convention. It's like a 4-day festival, so I'll be back on Sunday, so I'll probably do the next review on Monday, and then I'm going away for another work trip after that. So I'll catch up with that. Another book that I'm reading, actually, I'm not decided what book I'm reading after that. I probably won't have time over this time of this festival coming up, so I'll just do the audiobook. Anyway, thanks a lot for listening. If you've got any something to say about what I've said here, just email me, luke@juggler.net. That's the best way to get in contact with me. If you want to follow what books I'm reading, or if you want to suggest books to me, or if you want me to see what you're reading, which is actually something I enjoy just as much, become my friend on goodreads.com. My name is Luke Burridge on goodreads.com. So go to goodreads.com/Luke Burridge and follow my reviews or become my friend. I'm not quite sure what the difference is there. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. I put lots of different updates on there. Not all about book reviewing and writing, but all kinds of stuff there on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. And finally, you can read my blog and also read my own fiction. You can find that all of that stuff on my website, lukeburge.com /blog or /fiction.html. You can read my own work. That's it. Keep sending in the book suggestions and all your feedback. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.